completely forgotten about it. When the Alvarezes went looking for cores the company had drilled in the area, they were told that they'd been destroyed in a fire. Really, though, they had just been misplaced. The cores were finally located in 1991 and found to contain a layer of glass, rock that had melted, then rapidly cooled, right at the KT boundary. To the Alvarez camp, this was the clincher, and it was enough to move many uncommitted scientists into the pro-impact column. "Crater supports extinction theory," the Times announced. By this point, Luis Alvarez had died of complications from esophageal cancer. Walter dubbed the formation the Crater of Doom. It became more widely known, after the nearest town, as the Chicxulub Crater. Those 11 years seemed long at the time, but looking back, they seem very brief, Walter told me. Just think about it for a moment. Here you have a challenge to a uniformitarian viewpoint that basically every geologist and paleontologist had been trained in, as had their professors and their professors' professors, all the way back to Lyell. And what you saw was people looking at the evidence. And they gradually did come to change their minds. When the Alvarezes published their hypothesis, they knew of only 3 sites where the iridium layer was exposed. The 2 Walter had visited in Europe, and a 3rd, which they'd been sent samples from in New Zealand. In the decades since, dozens more have been located, including one near a nude beach in Biarritz, another in the Tunisian desert, and a 3rd in suburban New Jersey. Neil Landman, a paleontologist who specializes in ammonites, often takes field trips to this last site, and one warm fall day I invited myself to tag along. We met in front of the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, where Landman has his office in a turret overlooking Central Park, and, together with a pair of graduate students, headed south to the Lincoln Tunnel. Driving through northern New Jersey, we passed a succession of strip malls and car dealerships that seemed to repeat every few miles, like dominoes. Eventually, in the general vicinity of Princeton, we pulled into a parking lot next to a baseball field. Landman would prefer that I not reveal the exact location of the field, for fear of attracting fossil collectors. In the parking lot, we met up with a geologist named Matt Garb, who teaches at Brooklyn College. Garb, Landman, and the graduate students shouldered their gear. We circumnavigated the baseball field, empty in the middle of a school day, and struck out through the underbrush. Soon we reached a shallow creek. Its banks were covered in rust-colored slime. Brambles hung over the water. Fluttering from these were tattered banners of debris, lost plastic bags, scraps of newspaper, the rings from ancient six-packs. "To me, this is better than Gubbio," Landman announced. During the late Cretaceous, he explained to me, the park, the creek bed, and everything around us for many miles would have been underwater. At that point, the world was very warm. Lush forests grew in the Arctic, and sea levels were high. Most of New Jersey formed part of the continental shelf of what's now eastern North America, which, as the Atlantic was then much narrower, was considerably closer to what's now Europe. Landman pointed to a spot in the creek bed a few inches above the waterline. There, he told me, was the iridium layer. Although it wasn't in any way visibly different, Landman knew where it was because he'd had the sequence analyzed a few years earlier. Landman is stocky, with a wide face and a graying beard. He had dressed for the trip in khaki shorts and old sneakers. He waded into the creek to join the others, who were already hacking at the bed with their pickaxes. Soon, someone found a fossilized shark's tooth. Someone else dug out a piece of an ammonite. It was about the size of a strawberry and covered in little pimples or tubercles. Landman identified it as belonging to the species Discoscaphites iris. Ammonites floated through the world's shallow oceans for more than 300 million years, and their fossilized shells turn up all around the world. Pliny the Elder, who died in the eruption that buried Pompeii, was already familiar with them, although he considered them to be precious stones. The stones, he related in his Natural History, were said to bring prophetic dreams. In medieval England, ammonites were known as serpent stones, and in Germany, they were used to treat sick cows. In India, they were, and to a certain extent still are, revered as manifestations of Vishnu. Like nautiluses, to whom they were distantly related, ammonites constructed spiral shells divided into multiple chambers. The animals themselves occupied only the last and largest chamber. The rest were filled with air, an arrangement that might be compared to an apartment building in which just the penthouse is rented. The walls between the chambers, known as septa, were fantastically elaborate, folded into intricate ruffles like the edges of a snowflake. Individual species can be identified by the distinctive patterns of their pleats. This evolutionary development allowed ammonites to build shells that were at once light and robust, capable of withstanding many atmospheres worth of water pressure. Most ammonites could fit in a human hand. Some grew to be the size of kiddie pools. Based on the number of teeth ammonites had, 9, it's believed that their closest living kin are octopuses. But since ammonites' soft body parts are virtually never preserved, what exactly the animals looked like and how they lived are largely matters of inference. It's probable, though not certain, that they propelled themselves by shooting out a jet of water, which means that they could only travel backward. I remember when I was a kid taking paleontology, and I learned that pterodactyls could fly, Landman told me. My immediate question was, well, how high could they fly? And it's hard to come up with those numbers. I've studied ammonites for 40 years, and I'm still not sure exactly what they liked, he went on. I feel they liked water 20, 30, maybe 40 meters deep. They were swimmers, but not very good swimmers. I think they lived a quiet existence. In drawings, ammonites are usually depicted as resembling squids that have been stuffed into snail shells. Landman, however, has trouble with this depiction. He believes that ammonites, though commonly shown with several streaming tentacles, in fact had none. In a drawing that accompanies a recent journal article he published in the journal GeoBios, ammonites are shown looking like little more than blobs. They have stubby arm-like appendages, which are arrayed in a circle and connected by a web of tissue. In males, one of the arms pokes up out of the webbing to form the cephalopod version of a penis. Landman attended graduate school at Yale in the 1970s. As a student in the pre-Alvarez days, he was taught that ammonites were declining throughout the Cretaceous, so their eventual disappearance was nothing to get too worked up about. The sense was, oh, you know, the ammonites were just dying out, he recalled. Subsequent discoveries, many of them made by Landman himself, have shown that, on the contrary, ammonites were doing just fine. Here, you have lots of species, and we've collected thousands of specimens over the last few years, he told me over the clank of the others' pickaxes. Indeed, in the creek bed, Landman recently came upon two entirely new species of ammonite. One of these he named, in honor of a colleague, Discoscophytes minardi. The other he named, in honor of the place, Discoscophytes jerseyensis. Discoscophytes jerseyensis probably had little spines poking out of its shell, which, Landman speculates, helped the animal appear larger and more intimidating than it actually was. In their original paper, the Alvarezes proposed that the main cause of the KT mass extinction was not the impact itself, or even the immediate aftermath. The truly catastrophic effect of the asteroid, or to use the more generic term bolide, was the dust. In the intervening decades, this account has been subjected to numerous refinements. The date of the impact has also been pushed back to 66 million years ago. Though scientists still vigorously argue about many of the details, one version of the event runs as follows. The bolide arrived from the southeast, traveling at a low angle relative to the Earth, so that it came in not so much from above as from the side, like a plane losing altitude. When it slammed into the Yucatan Peninsula, it was moving at something like 45,000 miles per hour, and, due to its trajectory, North America was particularly hard hit. A vast cloud of searing vapor and debris raced over the continent, expanding as it moved and incinerating anything in its path. Basically, if you were a Triceratops in Alberta, you had about 2 minutes before you got vaporized, is how one geologist put it to me. In the process of excavating the enormous crater, the asteroid blasted into the air more than 50 times its own mass in pulverized rock. As the ejecta fell back through the atmosphere, the particles incandesced, lighting the sky everywhere at once from directly overhead and generating enough heat to, in effect, broil the surface of the planet. Owing to the composition of the Yucatan Peninsula, the dust thrown up was rich in sulfur. Sulfate aerosols are particularly effective at blocking sunlight, which is the reason a single volcanic eruption, like Krakatoa, can depress global temperatures for years. After the initial heat pulse, the world experienced a multi-season impact winter. Forests were decimated. Paleontologists, who study ancient spores and pollen, have found that diverse plant communities were replaced entirely by rapidly dispersing ferns. This phenomenon has become known as the fern spike. Marine ecosystems effectively collapsed, and they remained in that state for at least 500,000 and perhaps as many as several million years. The desolate post-impact sea has been dubbed the Strangelove Ocean. It's impossible to give anything close to a full account of the various species, genera, families, and even whole orders that went extinct at the KT boundary. On land, every animal larger than a cat seems to have died out. The event's most famous victims, the dinosaurs, or to be more precise, the non-avian dinosaurs, suffered 100% losses. Among the groups that were probably alive right up to the end of the Cretaceous were such familiar museum shop fixtures as hadrosaurs, ankylosaurs, tyrannosauruses, and triceratops. The cover of Walter Alvarez's book on the extinction, T-Rex in the Crater of Doom, shows an angry-looking tyrannosaurus reacting with horror to the impact. Pterosaurs, too, disappeared. Birds were also hard hit. Perhaps three-quarters of all bird families, perhaps more, went extinct. Enantiornithine birds, which retained such archaic features as teeth, were wiped out, as were hesperornithine birds, which were aquatic and for the most part flightless. The same goes for lizards and snakes. Around 4/5 of all species vanished. Mammals' ranks, too, were devastated. Something like 2/3 of the mammalian families living at the end of the Cretaceous disappear at the boundary. In the sea, plesiosaurs, which Cuvier had at first found implausible and then monstrous, died out. So did mosasaurs, belemnites, and, of course, ammonites. Bivalves, familiar to us today in the form of mussels and oysters, suffered heavy casualties, as did brachiopods, which look like clams but have a totally different anatomy, and bryozoans, which look like corals, but once again are totally unrelated. Several groups of marine microorganisms came within a micron or two of annihilation. Among planktonic foraminifera, something like 95% of all species disappeared, including Abathomphilus myeroensis, whose remains are found in the last layer of Cretaceous limestone in Gubbio. Planktonic foraminifera live near the ocean surface. Benthic species live on the ocean floor. In general, the more that's been learned about the KT boundary, the more wrong-headed Lyell's reading of the fossil record appears. The problem with the record is not that slow extinctions appear abrupt. It's that even abrupt extinctions are likely to look protracted. Every species has what is known as a preservation potential, the odds that an individual of that species will become fossilized, and this varies depending on, among other things, how common the animal is, where it lives, and what it's made out of. Thick-shelled marine organisms have a much better chance of being preserved than, say, birds with hollow bones. Following the KT extinction, it took millions of years for life to recover its former level of diversity. In the meantime, many surviving taxa seem to have shrunk. This phenomenon, which can be seen in the very tiny forams that show up above the iridium layer at Gubbio, is called the Lilliput effect. Landman, Garb, and the graduate students chipped away at the creek bed all morning. Although we were in the middle of the country's most densely populated state, not a single person passed by to wonder at what we were doing. As the day grew warmer and more humid, it was pleasant to stand ankle-deep in the water, though I did wonder about the reddish slime. Someone had brought along an empty cardboard box, and since I didn't have a pickaxe, I helped out by gathering up the fossils the others had found and arranging them in the box. Several more bits of Discoscaphites iris turned up, as well as pieces of an ammonite, Eubaculites carinatus, which, instead of having a spiral shell, had one that was long and slender and shaped like a spear. One theory of the ammonite's demise, popular in the early part of the 20th century, was that the uncoiled shells of species like Eubaculites carinatus indicated that the group had exhausted its practical possibilities and entered some sort of decadent Lady Gaga-ish phase. At one point, Garb rushed over in a flurry of excitement. He was carrying a fist-sized chunk of the creek bed and pointed out to me, along one edge, what looked like a tiny fingernail. This, he explained, was a piece of an ammonite's jaw. Ammonite jaws are more common than other body parts, but still extremely rare. "It was worth the trip just for that," he exclaimed. It's unclear what aspect of the impact, the heat, the darkness, the cold, the change in water chemistry, did in the ammonites. Nor is it entirely clear why some of their cephalopod cousins survived. In contrast to ammonites, nautiluses, for example, sailed through the extinction event. Pretty much all of the species known from the end of the Cretaceous survived into the Tertiary. One theory of the disparity starts with eggs. Ammonites produced very tiny eggs, only a few hundredths of an inch across. The resulting hatchlings, or ammonitelli, had no means of locomotion. They just floated near the surface of the water, drifting along with the current. Nautiluses, for their part, lay very large eggs, among the largest of all invertebrates, nearly an inch in diameter. Hatchling nautiluses emerge, after nearly a year's gestation, as miniature adults, and then immediately start swimming around, searching for food in the depths. Perhaps in the aftermath of the impact, conditions at the ocean surface were so toxic that ammonitelli could not survive, while lower down in the water column, the situation was less dire, so juvenile nautiluses managed to endure. Whatever the explanation, the contrasting fate of the two groups raises a key point. Everything and everyone alive today is descended from an organism that somehow survived the impact. But it does not follow from this that they, or we, are any better adapted. In times of extreme stress, the whole concept of fitness, at least in a Darwinian sense, loses its meaning. How could a creature be adapted, either well or ill, for conditions it has never before encountered in its entire evolutionary history? At such moments, what Paul Taylor, a paleontologist at London's Natural History Museum, calls the rules of the survival game, abruptly change. Traits that for many millions of years were advantageous all of a sudden become lethal, though it may be difficult, millions of years after the fact, to identify just what those traits were. And what holds for ammonites and nautiluses applies equally well to belemnites and squids, plesiosaurs and turtles, dinosaurs and mammals. The reason this book is being written by a hairy biped, rather than a scaly one, has more to do with dinosaurian misfortune than with any particular mammalian virtue. "There's nothing ammonites were doing wrong," Landman told me as we packed up the last fossils from the creek and prepared to head back to New York. "Their hatchlings would have been like plankton, which for all of their existence would have been terrific. What better way to get around and distribute the species? Yet here, in the end, it may well have been their undoing." Chapter 5. Welcome to the Anthropocene. Dicranogryptus zigzag. In 1949, a pair of Harvard psychologists recruited 24 undergraduates for an experiment about perception. The experiment was simple. Students were shown playing cards and asked to identify them as they flipped by. Most of the cards were perfectly ordinary, but a few had been doctored, so that the deck contained, among other oddities, a red 6 of spades and a black 4 of hearts. When the cards went by rapidly, the students tended to overlook the incongruities. They would, for example, assert that the red 6 of spades was a 6 of hearts, or call the black 4 of hearts a 4 of spades. When the cards went by more slowly, they struggled to make sense of what they were seeing. Confronted with a red spade, some said it looked purple, or brown, or rusty black. Others were completely flummoxed. "The symbols looked reversed or something," one observed. "I can't make the suit out, whatever it is," another exclaimed. "I don't know what color it is now or whether it's a spade or heart. I'm not even sure now what a spade looks like. My God." The psychologists wrote up their findings in a paper titled On the Perception of Incongruity, a Paradigm. Among those who found this paper intriguing was Thomas Kuhn. To Kuhn, the 20th century's most influential historian of science, the experiment was indeed paradigmatic. It revealed how people process disruptive information. Their first impulse is to force it into a familiar framework: hearts, spades, clubs. Signs of mismatch are disregarded for as long as possible. The red spade looks brown or rusty. At the point the anomaly becomes simply too glaring, a crisis ensues, what the psychologist dubbed the "my God" reaction. This pattern was, Kuhn argued in his seminal work, the structure of scientific revolutions, so basic that it shaped not only individual perceptions, but entire fields of inquiry. Data that did not fit the commonly accepted assumptions of a discipline would either be discounted or explained away for as long as possible. The more contradictions accumulated, the more convoluted the rationalizations became. In science, as in the playing card experiment, novelty emerges only with difficulty, Kuhn wrote. But then, finally, someone came along who was willing to call a red spade a red spade. Crisis led to insight, and the old framework gave way to a new one. This is how great scientific discoveries, or, to use the term Kuhn made so popular, paradigm shifts, took place. The history of the science of extinction can be told as a series of paradigm shifts. Until the end of the 18th century, the very category of extinction didn't exist. The more strange bones were unearthed, mammoths, Megatherium, mosasaurs. The harder naturalists had to squint to fit them into a familiar framework. And squint they did. The giant bones belonged to elephants that had been washed north, or hippos that had wandered west, or whales with malevolent grins. When Cuvier arrived in Paris, he saw that the mastodon's molars could not be fit into the established framework, a my God moment that led him to propose a whole new way of seeing them. Life, Cuvier recognized, had a history. This history was marked by loss and punctuated by events too terrible for human imagining. Though the world does not change with a change of paradigm, the scientist afterward works in a different world, is how Kuhn put it. In his Recherche sur les ossements fossiles, Cuvier listed dozens of espèces perdues, and he felt sure there were more awaiting discovery. Within a few decades, so many extinct creatures had been identified that Cuvier's framework began to crack. To keep pace with the growing fossil record, the number of disasters had to keep multiplying. God knows how many catastrophes would be needed, Lyle scoffed, poking fun at the whole endeavor. Lyle's solution was to reject catastrophe altogether. In Lyle's, and later Darwin's, formulation, extinction was a lonely affair. Each species that had vanished had shuffled off all on its own, a victim of the struggle for life, and its own defects as a less improved form. The uniformitarian account of extinction held up for more than a century. Then, with the discovery of the iridium layer, science faced another crisis. According to one historian, the Alvarez's work was as explosive for science as an impact would have been for Earth. The impact hypothesis dealt with a single moment in time, a terrible, horrible, no-good day at the end of the Cretaceous. But that single moment was enough to crack the framework of Lyell and Darwin. Catastrophes did happen. What is sometimes labeled neo-catastrophism, but is mostly nowadays just regarded as standard geology, holds that conditions on Earth change only very slowly, except when they don't. In this sense, the reigning paradigm is neither Cuvierian nor Darwinian, but combines key elements of both. Long periods of boredom interrupted occasionally by panic. Though rare, these moments of panic are disproportionately important. They determine the pattern of extinction, which is to say, the pattern of life. The path leads up a hill, across a fast-moving stream, back across the stream, and past the carcass of a sheep, which, more than just dead, looks deflated, like a lost balloon. The hill is bright green, but treeless. Generations of the sheep's aunts and uncles have kept anything from growing much above muzzle height. In my view, it's raining. Here in the southern uplands of Scotland, though, I'm told by one of the geologists I'm hiking with, this counts only as a light drizzle, or smur. Our goal is a spot called Dobbs Lynn, where, according to an old ballad, the devil himself was pushed over a precipice by a pious shepherd named Dob. By the time we reach the cliff, the smur seems to be smurring harder. There's a view over a waterfall, which crashes down into a narrow valley. A few yards farther up the path, there's a jagged outcropping of rock, which is striped vertically, like an umpire's jersey, in bands of light and dark. Jan Zalashevich, a stratigrapher from the University of Leicester, sets his rucksack down on the soggy ground and adjusts his red rain jacket. He points to one of the light-colored stripes. Bad things happened in here, he tells me. The rocks that we are looking at date back some 445 million years to the last part of the Ordovician period. At that point, the globe was experiencing a continental logjam. Most of the land, including what's now Africa, South America, Australia, and Antarctica, was joined into one giant mass, Gondwana, which spanned more than 90 degrees latitude. England belonged to the continent, now lost, of Avalonia, and Dobbs Lynn lay in the southern hemisphere, at the bottom of an ocean known as the Iapetus. The Ordovician period followed directly after the Cambrian, which is known, even to the most casual of geology students, for the explosion of new life forms that appeared. A useful mnemonic for remembering the geologic periods of the last half billion years is, "Camels often sit down carefully, perhaps their joints creak." Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Carboniferous, Permian, Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous. The mnemonic unfortunately runs out before the most recent periods, the Paleogene, the Neogene, and the current Quaternary. The Ordovician, too, was a time when life took off excitedly in new directions, the so-called Ordovician radiation, though it remained for the most part still confined to the water. During the Ordovician, the number of marine families tripled, and the seas filled with creatures we would more or less recognize, the progenitors of today's starfish and sea urchins and snails and nautiluses, and also plenty that we would not, conodonts, which probably were shaped like eels, trilobites, which sort of resembled horseshoe crabs, and giant sea scorpions, which, as best can be determined, looked like something out of a nightmare. The first reefs appeared, and the ancestors of today's clams took on their clam-like form. Toward the middle of the Ordovician, the first plants began to colonize the land. These were very early mosses or liverworts, and they clung low to the ground, as if not quite sure what to make of their new surroundings. At the end of the Ordovician, some 444 million years ago, the oceans emptied out. Something like 85% of marine species died off. For a time, the event was regarded as one of those pseudo-catastrophes that just went to show how little the fossil record could be trusted. Today, it's seen as the first of the Big Five extinctions, and it's thought to have taken place in two brief, intensely deadly pulses. Though its victims are nowhere near as charismatic as those taken out at the end of the Cretaceous, it, too, marks a turning point in life's history, a moment when the rules of the game suddenly flipped, with consequences that, for all intents and purposes, will last forever. Those animals and plants that made it through the Ordovician extinction went on to make the modern world, the British paleontologist Richard Forty has observed. Had the list of survivors been one jot different, then so would the world today. Zalashevich, my guide at Dobbs Lynn, is a slight man with shaggy hair, pale blue eyes, and a pleasantly formal manner. He is an expert on graptolites, a once vast and extremely diverse class of marine organisms that thrived during the Ordovician and then, in the extinction event, were very nearly wiped out. To the naked eye, graptolite fossils look like scratches, or in some cases tiny petroglyphs. The word graptolite comes from the Greek meaning written rock. It was coined by Linnaeus, who dismissed graptolites as mineral encrustations trying to pass themselves off as the remnants of animals. Viewed through a hand lens, they often prove to have lovely, evocative shapes. One species suggests a feather, another a lyre, the third the frond of a fern. Graptolites were colonial animals. Each individual, known as a zooid, built itself a tiny tubular shelter, known as a theca, which was attached to its neighbors, like a row house. A single graptolite fossil thus represents a whole community, which drifted or more probably swam along as a single entity, feeding off even smaller plankton. No one knows exactly what the zooids looked like. As with ammonites, the creature's soft parts resist preservation. But graptolites are now believed to be related to pterobranches, a small and hard-to-find class of living marine organisms that resemble Venus flytraps. Graptolites had a habit, endearing from a stratigrapher's point of view, of speciating, spreading out, and dying off, all in relatively short order. Zalashevich compares them to Natasha, the tender heroine of War and Peace. They were, he says, delicate, nervous, and very sensitive to things around them. This makes them useful index fossils. Successive species can be used to identify successive layers of rock. Finding graptolites at Dobbs Lynn turns out, even for the most amateur of collectors, to be easy. The dark stone in the jagged outcropping is shale. It takes only a gentle hammer tap to dislodge a chunk. Another tap splits the chunk laterally. It divides like a book, opening to a well-thumbed page. Often on the stony surface there's nothing to see, but just as often there's one or more faint marks, messages from a former world. One of the graptolites I happen across has been preserved with peculiar clarity. It's shaped like a set of false eyelashes, but very small, as if for a Barbie. Zalashevich tells me, doubtless exaggerating, that I have found a museum-quality specimen. I pocket it. Once Zalashevich shows me what to look for, I too can make out the arc of the extinction. In the dark shales, graptolites are plentiful and varied. Soon I've collected so many, the pockets of my jacket are sagging. Many of the fossils are variations on the letter V, with two arms branching away from a central node. Some look like zippers, others like wishbones. Still others have arms growing off their arms, like tiny trees. The lighter stone, by contrast, is barren. There's barely a graptolite to be found in it. The transition from one state to another, from black stone to gray, from many graptolites to almost none, appears to have occurred suddenly, and, according to Zalasowicz, did occur suddenly. The change here from black to gray marks a tipping point, if you like, from a habitable seafloor to an uninhabitable one, he tells me. And one might have seen that in the span of a human lifetime. He describes this transition as distinctly Cuvierian. Two of Zalashevich's colleagues, Dan Condon and Ian Millar, of the British Geological Survey, have made the hike with us out to Dobbs Lynn. The pair are experts in isotope chemistry and are planning to collect samples from each of the stripes in the outcropping, samples they hope will contain tiny crystals of zircon. Once back at the lab, they will dissolve the crystals and run the results through a mass spectrometer. This will allow them to say, give or take 500,000 years or so, when each of the layers was formed. Millar is Scottish and claims to be undaunted by the smur. Eventually, though, even he has to acknowledge that, in English, it's pouring. Rivulets of mud are running down the face of the outcropping, making it impossible to get clean samples. It is decided that we will try again the following day. The three geologists pack up their gear, and we squish back down the trail to the car. Zalashevich has made reservations at a bed and breakfast in the nearby town of Moffat, whose attractions, I have read, include the world's narrowest hotel and a bronze sheep. Once everyone has changed into dry clothes, we meet in the sitting room of the B&B for tea. Zalashevich has brought along several recent publications of his on graptolites. Settling back in their chairs, Condon and Millar roll their eyes. Zalashevich ignores them, patiently explaining to me the import of his latest monograph, Graptolites in British Stratigraphy, which runs 66 single-spaced pages and includes detailed illustrations of more than 650 species. In the monograph, the effects of the extinction show up more systematically, if also less vividly than on the rain-slicked hillside. Until the end of the Ordovician, V-shaped graptolites dominated. These included species like Dicranograptus zigzag, whose tiny cups were arranged along arms that curled away and then toward each other, like tusks. and Adelagraptus divergens, which, in addition to its two main arms, had little sidearms that stuck out like thumbs. Only a handful of graptolite species survived the extinction event. Eventually, these diversified and repopulated the seas in the Silurian. But Silurian graptolites had a streamlined body plan, more like a stick than a set of branches. The V-shape had been lost, never to reappear. Here, writ very, very small, is the fate of the dinosaurs, the mosasaurs, and the ammonites, a once highly successful form, relegated to oblivion. What happened 444 million years ago to nearly wipe out the graptolites, not to mention the conodonts, the brachiopods, the echinoderms, and the trilobites? In the years immediately following the publication of the Alvarez hypothesis, it was generally believed, at least among those who considered the hypothesis more than codswallop, that a unified theory of mass extinction was at hand. If an asteroid had produced one chasm in the fossil record, it seemed reasonable to expect that impacts had caused all of them. This idea received a boost in 1984, when a pair of paleontologists from the University of Chicago published a comprehensive analysis of the marine fossil record. The study revealed that in addition to the five major mass extinctions, there had been many lesser extinction events. When all of these were considered together, a pattern emerged. Mass extinction seemed to take place at regular intervals of roughly 26 million years. Extinction, in other words, occurred in periodic bursts, like cicadas crawling out of the earth. The two paleontologists, David Raup and Jack Sapkowski, were unsure what had caused these bursts, but their best guess was some astronomical and astrophysical cycle having to do with the passage of our solar system through the spiral arms of the Milky Way. A group of astrophysicists, as it happened, colleagues of the Alvarezes at Berkeley, took the speculation one step farther. The periodicity, the group argued, could be explained by a small companion star to the Sun, which every 26 million years passed through the Oort cloud, producing comet showers that rained destruction on the Earth. The fact that no one had ever seen this star, dubbed with horror movie flair Nemesis, was to the Berkeley group a problem, but not an insurmountable one. There were plenty of small stars out there, still waiting to be catalogued. In the popular media, what became known as the Nemesis Affair generated almost as much excitement as the original asteroid hypothesis. One reporter described the story as having everything but sex in the royal family. Time ran a cover article, which was soon followed by another disapproving editorial in the New York Times. The editorial poo-pooed the notion of a mysterious death star. This time, the newspaper was onto something. Though the Berkeley group spent the next year or so scanning the heavens for Nemesis, no glimmer of a death star was discovered. More significantly, upon further analysis, the evidence for periodicity began to fall apart. If there's a consensus, it's that what we were seeing was a statistical fluke, David Raup told me. Meanwhile, the search for iridium and other signs of extraterrestrial impacts was faltering. Together with many others, Luis Alvarez had thrown himself into this hunt. At a time when scientific collaboration with the Chinese was practically unheard of, he'd managed to obtain rock samples from southern China that spanned the boundary between the Permian and Triassic periods. The end Permian or Permo-Triassic extinction was the biggest of the Big Five, an episode that came scarily close to eliminating multicellular life altogether. Luis was thrilled to find a layer of clay nestled between the bands of rock from southern China, just as there had been at Gubbio. We felt sure that there would be lots of iridium there, he would later recall. But the Chinese clay turned out to be, chemically speaking, mundane. its iridium content, too infinitesimal to be measured. Higher than normal iridium levels were subsequently detected at the end of the Ordovician, in rocks from, among other places, Dobbs Lynn. However, none of the other telltale signs of an impact, such as shocked quartz, turned up in the right time frame, and it was determined that the elevated iridium levels were more plausibly, if less spectacularly, attributed to the vagaries of sedimentation. The current theory is that the end Ordovician extinction was caused by glaciation. For most of the period, a so-called greenhouse climate prevailed. Carbon dioxide levels in the air were high, and so too were sea levels and temperatures. But right around the time of the first pulse of extinction, the one that wreaked havoc among the graptolites, CO2 levels dropped. Temperatures fell, and Gondwana froze. Evidence of the Ordovician glaciation has been found in such far-flung remnants of the supercontinent as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Brazil. Sea levels plummeted, and many marine habitats were eliminated, presumably to the detriment of marine organisms. The ocean's chemistry changed too. Among other things, colder water holds more oxygen. No one is sure whether it was the temperature change or one of the many knock-on effects that killed the graptolites. As Zalashevich put it to me, "You have a body in the library and a half a dozen butlers wandering around looking sheepish." Nor does anyone know what caused the change to begin with. One theory has it that the glaciation was produced by the early mosses that colonized the land and, in so doing, helped draw carbon dioxide out of the air. If this is the case, the first mass extinction of animals was caused by plants. The end Permian extinction also seems to have been triggered by a change in the climate. But in this case, the change went in the opposite direction. Right at the time of extinction, 252 million years ago, there was a massive release of carbon into the air, so massive that geologists have a hard time even imagining where all the carbon could have come from. Temperatures soared, the seas warmed by as much as 18 degrees, and the chemistry of the oceans went haywire, as if in an out-of-control aquarium. The water became acidified, and the amount of dissolved oxygen dropped so low that many organisms probably, in effect, suffocated. Reefs collapsed. The end Permian extinction took place, though not quite in a human lifetime, in geologic terms nearly as abruptly. According to the latest research by Chinese and American scientists, the whole episode lasted no more than 200,000 years, and perhaps less than 100,000. By the time it was over, something like 90% of all species on Earth had been eliminated. Even intense global warming and ocean acidification seem inadequate to explain losses on such a staggering scale, and so additional mechanisms are still being sought. One hypothesis has it that the heating of the oceans favored bacteria that produce hydrogen sulfide, which is poisonous to most other forms of life. According to this scenario, hydrogen sulfide accumulated in the water, killing off marine creatures, then it leaked into the air, killing off most everything else. The sulfate-reducing bacteria changed the color of the oceans, and the hydrogen sulfide the color of the heavens. The science writer Carl Zimmer has described the end Permian world as a truly grotesque place, where glassy, purple seas released poisonous bubbles that rose to a pale green sky. If 25 years ago it seemed that all mass extinctions would ultimately be traced to the same cause, now the reverse seems true. As in Tolstoy, every extinction event appears to be unhappy, and fatally so, in its own way. It may, in fact, be the very freakishness of the events that renders them so deadly. All of a sudden, organisms find themselves facing conditions for which they are, evolutionarily, completely unprepared. I think that, after the evidence became pretty strong for the impact at the end of the Cretaceous, those of us who were working on this naively expected that we would go out and find evidence of impacts coinciding with the other events, Walter Alvarez told me. And it's turned out to be much more complicated. We're seeing right now that a mass extinction can be caused by human beings. So it's clear that we do not have a general theory of mass extinction. That evening in Moffat, once everyone had had enough of tea and graptolites, we went out to the pub on the ground floor of the world's narrowest hotel. After a pint or two, the conversation turned to another one of Zalashevitz's favorite subjects, giant rats. Rats have followed humans to just about every corner of the globe, and it is Zalashevitz's professional opinion that one day they will take over the Earth. Some number will probably stay rat-sized and rat-shaped, he told me, but others may well shrink or expand, particularly if there's been epidemic extinction and ecospace opens up. Rats may be best placed to take advantage of that. And we know that change in size can take place fairly quickly. I recalled a rat I once watched drag a pizza crust along the tracks at an Upper West Side subway station. I imagined it waddling through a deserted tunnel, blown up to the size of a Doberman. Though the connection might seem tenuous, Zalashevitz's interest in giant rats represents a logical extension of his interest in graptolites. He is fascinated by the world that preceded humans, and also, increasingly, by the world that humans will leave behind. One project informs the other. When he studies the Ordovician, he's trying to reconstruct the distant past on the basis of the fragmentary clues that remain. Fossils, isotopes of carbon, layers of sedimentary rock. When he contemplates the future, he's trying to imagine what will remain of the present once the contemporary world has been reduced to fragments, fossils, isotopes of carbon, layers of sedimentary rock. Zalashevitz is convinced that even a moderately competent stratigrapher will, at the distance of 100 million years or so, be able to tell that something extraordinary happened at the moment in time that counts for us as today. This is the case even though 100 million years from now, all that we consider to be the great works of man, the sculptures and the libraries, the monuments and the museums, the cities and the factories, will be compressed into a layer of sediment not much thicker than a cigarette paper. We have already left a record that is now indelible, Zalashevitz has written. One of the ways we've accomplished this is through our restlessness. Often purposefully, and just as often not, humans have rearranged the Earth's biota, transporting the flora and fauna of Asia to the Americas, and of the Americas to Europe, and of Europe to Australia. Rats have consistently been on the vanguard of these movements, and they have left their bones scattered everywhere, including on islands so remote that humans never bothered to settle them. The Pacific rat, Rattus exulans, a native of Southeast Asia, traveled with Polynesian seafarers to, among many other places, Hawaii, Fiji, Tahiti, Tonga, Samoa, Easter Island, and New Zealand. Encountering few predators, stowaway Rattus exulans multiplied into what the New Zealand paleontologist Richard Holdaway has described as a gray rat tide that turned everything edible into rat protein. A recent study of pollen and animal remains on Easter Island concluded it wasn't humans who deforested the landscape. Rather, it was the rats that came along for the ride and then bred unchecked. The native palms couldn't produce seeds fast enough to keep up with their appetites. When Europeans arrived in the Americas and then continued west to the islands the Polynesians had settled, they brought with them the even more adaptable Norway rat, Rattus norveticus. In many places, Norway rats, which are actually from China, outcompeted the earlier rat invaders and, in so doing, ravaged the bird and reptile populations the Pacific rats had missed. Rats thus might be said to have created their own ecospace, which their progeny seemed well positioned to dominate. The descendants of today's rats, according to Zalashevich, will radiate out to fill the niches that Rattus exulans and Rattus norveticus helped empty. He imagines the rats of the future evolving into new shapes and sizes, some smaller than shrews, others as large as elephants. We might, he has written, include among them, for curiosity's sake and to keep our options open, a species or two of a large naked rodent living in caves, shaping rocks as primitive tools, and wearing the skins of other mammals that they have killed and eaten. Meanwhile, whatever the future holds for rats, the extinction event that they are helping to bring about will leave its own distinctive mark. Not yet anywhere near as drastic as the one recorded in the mudstone at Dobbs Lynn, or in the clay layer in Gubbio, it will nevertheless appear in the rocks as a turning point. Climate change, itself a driver of extinction, will also leave behind geologic traces, as will nuclear fallout and river diversion, and monoculture farming, and ocean acidification. For all of these reasons, Zalashevich believes that we have entered a new epoch, which has no analog in Earth's history. Geologically, he has observed, this is a remarkable episode. Over the years, a number of different names have been suggested for the new age that humans have ushered in. The noted conservation biologist Michael Soule has suggested that instead of the Cenozoic, we now live in the Catastrophozoic era. Michael Samways, an entomologist at South Africa's Stellenbosch University, has floated the term Homogenocene. Daniel Pauly, a Canadian marine biologist, has proposed the Mixocene, from the Greek word for slime, and Andrew Revkin, an American journalist, has offered the Anthrocene. Most of these terms owe their origins, indirectly at least, to Lyell, who, back in the 1830s, coined the words Eocene, Miocene, and Pliocene. The word Anthropocene is the invention of Paul Crutzen, a Dutch chemist who shared a Nobel Prize for discovering the effects of ozone-depleting compounds. The importance of this discovery is difficult to overstate. Had it not been made, and had the chemicals continued to be widely used, the ozone hole that opens up every spring over Antarctica would have expanded until eventually it encircled the entire Earth. One of Crutzen's fellow Nobelists reportedly came home from his lab one night and told his wife, "The work is going well, but it looks like it might be the end of the world." Crutzen told me that the word Anthropocene came to him while he was sitting at a meeting. The meeting's chairman kept referring to the Holocene, the wholly recent epoch, which began at the conclusion of the last ice age, 11,700 years ago, and which continues, at least officially, to this day. "Let's stop it," Crutzen recalled blurting out. "We are no longer in the Holocene. We are in the Anthropocene." Well, it was quiet in the room for a while. At the next coffee break, the Anthropocene was the main topic of conversation. Someone came up to Crutzen and suggested that he patent the term. Crutzen wrote up his idea in a short essay, Geology of Mankind, that ran in Nature. It seems appropriate to assign the term Anthropocene to the present, in many ways human-dominated geological epoch, he observed. Among the many geologic scale changes people have affected, Crutzen cited the following. Human activity has transformed between a third and a half of the land surface of the planet. Most of the world's major rivers have been dammed or diverted. Fertilizer plants produce more nitrogen than is fixed naturally by all terrestrial ecosystems. Fisheries remove more than a third of the primary production of the ocean's coastal waters. Humans use more than half of the world's readily accessible freshwater runoff. Most significantly, Crutzen said, people have altered the composition of the atmosphere. Owing to a combination of fossil fuel combustion and deforestation, the concentration